you know, B2B marketing, yeah, part of it's getting found, but a lot of it, like how many deals you lose because people don't trust you and don't believe in you, or aren't willing to risk their career on you, you know, building that out is a much bigger opportunity than getting a few more clicks on a, you know, AI created blog post.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, we're going to get ready for a great discussion on a particular area of business that I think I have found a significant opportunity and a lot of people not really putting it into their overall mix when it comes to sales and marketing. And that is, how do I take and leverage what has happened in regards to our customer success and use it to drive new business opportunities and to have that discussion and talk about new ways of thinking. We have Julian Lumpkin on the show today. Julian, welcome.
Thanks, Jim. Great to be here.
So I would dare to say, when we look at the traditional approaches that people have, if at all, in regards to, you know, leveraging the value and benefit that they have been able to provide to their existing clients, they really just don't know how to get, you know, the opportunity to generate even more out of it. We often talked about the simple things as far as, you know, referrals and things like that, but how do you actually do that to where it becomes something that will, you know, cause people, you know, to say, this is a business that I want to actually work with, that I want to partner with. But before we get into that discussion, if you could just share a little bit about your background with the B2B DM gang so they can get to know you a little better.
Sure. My background is a little bit unique because I am the founder of SuccessKit, a small marketing agency that focuses on creating case studies and video testimonials for businesses. But my background is actually in sales. So I started my career as an individual contributor. Eventually, found myself at a technology startup where I again started as an individual contributor and then moved into management. And one of the things that I noticed when I was the sales manager there was how consistently and more effectively the best sales reps used examples of success throughout their sales process. And what I mean by that is not just, you know, throwing a PDF at someone during the sales process and thinking that's going to close the deal, because as we'll talk about, it doesn't work that way. But the best sales reps naturally and organically integrate their own customer success stories or the company's customer success stories into their sales process. And the same is true with marketing. And I noticed that a lot of companies struggle to get case studies and video testimonials and other forms of customer success proof to their sales team. And that's what led me to start SuccessKit. I've been doing it for about 7 years now. Plan on doing it for many more.
So when you started, when you and I started talking before we started recording, you know, I had just mentioned something in regards to the evolution and lack of leveraging some of this insight, not formalizing the process. And I said something about testimonials being useless. And you said to me, well, I don't know if I'd say it that way. But to me, when you actually provided the answer, in regards to what we needed to do, it kind of actually, to me, kind of reaffirmed my initial point. But I think it's important for you to explain from your perspective what I was meaning and trying to get at with my, you know, limited knowledge. And I would dare to say a lot of listeners, watchers, you know, limited, you know, experience in this is how are testimonials useless and how do we potentially make them to be very profitable?
Yeah, it's such an interesting point. And I think there's a lot of things now, and testimonials or case studies or any of these things we're talking about, where certain people will say and think these are useless. And to an extent, it's true, because if you don't have a real strategy for collecting the right testimonials, documenting the success, and then using it at appropriate times, it's pretty much useless. We're all used to seeing happy testimonials. What makes them valuable is the context that they're shared in, whether that's in marketing or directly in the sales process. If we're having a conversation or if we're in a sales process and I just bring up a list of five people who said great things about me, who cares? You know, that's where testimonials are useless, where, you know, that's just not enough. On the other hand, and we'll talk about how to get here, if we're having a sales conversation and you say, well, I really like what you're doing, but I'm worried about the implementation process because, you know, we use HubSpot, and I'm just making up an example. And I say, oh, yeah, I totally understand what you mean. Maybe ask a qualifying question. That actually reminds me of Bob at ABC Company. He also previously was on HubSpot before we did this implementation. And let me show you and talk to you about what he said about it. That is something you're going to listen to because I'm connecting you. I'm listening to what you're saying, the buyer. And this is, again, this is true in marketing too, in a little less direct way. And then sharing something that's actually relevant, that's showing that I understand what you're telling me and that I authentically deal with situations like that all day, and just proving that to you. So those are the two different ways that testimonials can be completely useless. And then on the other end of the spectrum, they can be the best thing that happens to your sales process.
Well, even when you said that, I started thinking about, well, that's a really targeted way of doing what everybody calls storytelling that is significantly more effective. Isn't that true?
Exactly. 100%. You know, customer success and testimonials are stories when they're used. It all comes back to how they're used, being used appropriately and being created appropriately. And, you know, the most important thing, even more important than the quality of the case study and the testimony or the testimonial itself, is the context with which it's set up, because it's just totally different when you feel like someone is just trying to show off their testimonials versus that second example where we're having a conversation and I'm integrating real customer proof into the conversation.
Well, as you say that, and you kind of mentioned and hit on a little bit, and I think it would be appropriate to kind of talk about the evolution or the maturation or the journey process of getting here and starting with like why this is important.
Yeah. So I think the why behind is important is pretty simple, and you can kind of see it in the B2C market which usually tends to be a little more forward, and then the B2B market that people, you know, psychologists, marketers, and advertisers discovered a long time ago that people react to seeing people they perceive as similar to them or who they want to be like and hearing their stories. It's just a more natural way to learn. So they're really important for that very, very basic reason. And you've probably seen it in the B2C world, you know, completely take over, where most commercials have a testimonial element. Everyone looks at reviews before buying things. And the B2B world that's been building for a while and becoming really important. But there's this added aspect, I think, in the B2B world that makes it even more crucial right now, which is that buyers have a lot of mistrust of salespeople and their marketing campaigns. So the idea behind a good case study is it lets you share your story of what you do well, but not through your own eyes, not through here's what we do. It's real kind of customer proof, like we talked about, but also real stories that are just coming from a perspective that prospect is going to be more likely to really trust and want to engage with.
Well, as we know, B2B is always kind of lagged in regards to, you know, catching up to some of the things that you're referring to, meaning modern day psychology. And I would dare to say too, and what I have seen, and I would like to get your insights in on this because you've been doing this for several years. What has changed regarding to pre-COVID versus post-COVID in regards to the work that you do?
Yeah, I think the biggest change is that more digital assets and good ones and content are expected. Most B2B companies during COVID, you know, stopped spending a lot of areas, stopped doing a lot of things, maybe trimmed down. But most of them increased the amount of digital assets that they have, whether it's investing in kind of entertainment style content to attract viewers, brochures or things like case studies and testimonials. I think the bar is just significantly higher because most B2B companies took that period to improve. So I think the bar is higher for what's kind of a standard kind of expectation from buyers between now and then.
Okay. So you kind of hit on, you know, the why and all of that. And I would dare to say you probably even have some, you know, financial impacts associated with all this as well. But, you know, take us through the next step. We've gotten through the why. I need to do this. How do I actually continue to go down this process?
Yeah. So the how really depends on kind of where you are as a company and as far as resources, clients, et cetera. But there are a few kind of like just very basic things. Like we're talking about how to do this really well, but the reality is, you know, a lot of small to medium businesses don't do this at all. In which case, you know, just getting a very basic set of 3 to 6 case studies and videos should be priority number one. And I always, you know, like to describe that, like, and we'll talk more about how this applies to bigger companies that are trying to get from like, okay, we've got some case studies, but we want to really take this to the next level. If you're a small to medium company, if you can go down that road, great. But really, you know, don't let that kind of idea of perfection stop you from just getting something done. So I'm going to answer in two different ways. So if you're a small to medium company, it is so simple. And you've got, it's mostly just about taking action and not letting this stay on the back burner. You know, identify your top 5 to 10 clients. You either know them, your account management knows them, and then make a simple direct ask of them. We want to create written case studies and videos. I would try to do both for each one since you're only going to do a few. Ideally, hire a third party to help with the interview so you get that perspective and can also help get it done. But if you can't, do it yourself, record it, store it on Zoom, and then take that kind of 30-minute Zoom call to make a, you know, 2-page written case study, and then maybe some short videos for social media. Do that 6 times. Now, then you're going to be in a solid position. Your website is going to be able to have case studies on it. Your sales team is going to have a few different contexts and ways to show case studies. And if you're a small to medium-sized business, just by doing that, you could probably get it done in 3 to 6 months. You're going to be ahead of the curve. That's where I'd start. Go ahead, and then we can talk about kind of the next level for bigger companies.
Well, one of the things that you had mentioned that I wanted to actually hone in a little bit on, you said using at appropriate times. What did you mean by that?
So when I say using it at appropriate times, what I really mean is all when done correctly by a person who understands the context of the case study through all parts of the sales cycle. When you are trying to reach out to someone, inserting, you know, a relevant quote maybe is an afterthought. When you're explaining the product to someone, you're obviously going to explain the appropriate details to them, but then also how someone just like them uses it. When you're going kind of the next steps, you're sharing, again, truly relevant examples. So I think it's throughout all phases of the sales and marketing process, as long as it's done naturally. And that has to be based on an authentic understanding of the case study and being a good sales rep and authentically understanding the prospect that you're speaking with.
Gotcha. Okay. So go ahead and talk about the other.
Yeah. So that was for, if you're a small company, get 6 done. Don't overthink it. You know, I see people all the time. I talk to people and they become my clients. I talk to them and then, you know, they say, oh yeah, we need this, but we got to figure out the strategy of this. I talk to them 2 years later and they still have nothing. So that it happens all the time. I'm sure some people fall into that. Avoid that. If you don't have any case studies, just get to 6 as quickly as possible. Now, if you're looking to take the next steps there, let's say you have 6, 8, 10 case studies, but you want to really turn this into a competitive advantage. What we typically do with that clients at that point is to develop some sort of matrix or just list of things that are important to your sales cycle. I'll start with the most simple matrix. And some of them do come out just like this. They'll say, all right, we sell to 3 different personas. We sell to the, you know, VP of operations, through the financial department, and then the CEO. So that's going to be on maybe the x-axis of the matrix. So those are your three core personas, and they may have different perspectives. And then you'll say, okay, and we also sell to, you know, five different industries or five different products for five different industries. That will be on the y-axis of the matrix. And then you say, okay, these are the core areas we sell to. Let's make sure to get a case study for each one of them. So that way, when you are selling to the CFO in the agricultural space, you have a case study that talks from the perspective of a CFO in the agricultural space. And this can be done, I just described in the most basic way, but there's many different ways to cut and slice this approach. And, you know, there's no one size fits all. So it's going to be based, you're going to know your own sales and marketing process and say, what are the most important elements? For some of my clients, you know, they sell the same persona all the time, but they solve very different initial problems that the client has. In that case, their matrix can have most important problems that the prospect initially had. So again, simplifying it, it's looking and thinking and talking to your sales team about what are the most important elements in our sales process. Why, when do people not trust us? Where are we losing them? What are the aspects that make us lose deals we should win? Understanding those, writing those down, and then looking at your existing client base and say, who was like that? You know, who had those problems initially and we solved them for, and then going after them for case studies and documenting them. So it's about tying your prospects, the way understand the way your prospects are thinking, what they're concerned about, what they care about, why they're ignoring you or not trusting you, and then finding truly relevant examples in your customer base that directly address their questions or concerns.
I would also have to imagine that when you start talking about relevancy, there, you know, there could be some nuance in that. And an example would be to where you talked about the industry segments and sectors. Well, what if I want to expand in a new one? And I don't have a whole lot of client success stories associated with this new vertical that we're trying to make, you know, pathways into. I mean, what do I do in that situation?
Yeah. So there's no, you know, when you're expanding into new markets, you're just not going to have the, you know, perfect case study necessarily for that market. And you can look for other things on that matrix that line up with them, but you're probably going to have to be very direct with your new potential client that this is a new market for us. You can see we've done similar work for people like you, but in very different industries. And then, as you know, and use that as an opportunity. If you become a client, will you, you know, do a case study with us? So I think when you're going into new markets, and this shows how important it is, because anyone who's done sales, myself included, knows how hard it is to go into a new market. And the reason it's so hard is because that person wants to see, oh, have you done something like this for me? So there's no magic bullet there. But I think it shows why these assets are so important.
Okay. So if I'm sitting there and I'm looking at, well, maybe I'm in a startup scenario and I'm wanting to move into the growth, you know, phase of my business, you know, I have actually built this particular product and validated off of, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 clients. And I'm still running into that, you know, situation of, I haven't been doing it very long. I don't have a lot of, you know, client success stories associated with it. And I want to be able to use, you know, this, you know, impact, you know, proof, you know, to be able to help to grow my business. What approach would I take in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, the key there is, and I've worked with people in this exact situation, is obviously, you know, if you've got 4 test clients who started with you, to get all 4 of them to create a written case study and a video. And the good news is that when you're in that situation, those super early clients tend to be very willing to participate in a case study. They know you're early, they understand the importance of it. So, you know, the key there is to, you know, when you're a big company, you try to, you know, you need to get some small percentage of your clients to participate. In that situation, your goal should be to get, unless there's some reason one of them can't, every single one of them. And that also comes into when you're setting up these trials, this in this early part of your company, is talking to them up front and saying, like, all right, we're going to give you this great deal. You're locking in legacy pricing, which usually people do when they're an initial client, to make one of the things brought up early on. And is to say, as soon as you see these results, that we'll be able to, you know, create a case study and video testimonial so that we can find more people like you.
Well,
people do have success there.
Well, and so you bring up a really interesting point is like, you know, what do I do from an expectation setting perspective? I mean, when do I approach them to say, you know, within the sales process, you know, is it, you know, before they even close, you know, is it, do you write it into contracts? Do you, I mean, how do you approach, you know, having people to commit and then follow through on providing these success stories?
Yeah, great question. So I'll start by saying my personal opinion is that having it written into contracts is not wise, because if you're trying to force your client to participate in a case study and they're saying, I don't want to, and you're having to say, but it's in the contract, that's not a good case study candidate. And similarly, I've seen companies say in the contract early on before they sign with them, oh, you can't do any case studies about us, but once they become a super happy client, then they're fine with it. So my perspective is that, you know, and granted, if we're talking, you know, I'm sure there's specific industries and situations where this advice doesn't apply, but very generally, I wouldn't worry about the contract. I wouldn't worry about getting contracted. The case studies come down to whether the person wants to do it and can get approval at their company. You don't want to force them based on a contract. And again, they may be able to do it even if it's not in a contract. So that's what I'll say about the contracts. As far as, yeah, setting them up in advance, yeah, the earlier the better, right? In the sales process. Obviously, you don't want to make that a focal point. But to just, I think just bringing it up during the sales process is going to make them more likely to do it. I don't think you need to get any commitment. One thing I do see people using in the sales process is if they're asking for something very specific or a discount, or, you know, you're stretching your resources in some way to accommodate them, then maybe, and again, I don't think it even needs to be contractual, but then it might make sense to set up and say, okay, we'll do this for you, but once this works, we need you to be in a case study. Otherwise, I think it's just mentioning it early on while you're showing them case studies, and you can kind of say, like, it's actually a good technique to get themselves like thinking about being successful with you, of saying like, I'm showing you this case study and say, oh, by the way, you know, if we can achieve this for you in this, I hope you'll be in a case study just like this. So while you're showing them case studies, to bring it up and kind of get them thinking about being a happy client of yours. So you can kind of plant the seeds then. As far as when to make the ask after, if you're just kind of asking everyone, this is maybe oversimplified, but as soon as they have experienced your product and service to the extent that they can speak about a direct result or benefit. So sometimes that's immediately after onboarding, sometimes that's 6 months, but I think they need to be able to say that they've used the product and to some extent either have solved or are making direct progress in solving their problem and achieving a result.
Well, as you're talking, I'm like, okay, we need to do the ask when they're excited.
Yeah. Doing the ask kind of like right when they're achieving that results is really important. And also who the ask comes from. You know, it shouldn't be a stranger they've never spoken to in marketing. It should be the person who's closest to them as the client. I think obviously the timing and the excitement matters too, but equally important, I think, is their relationship with their main contact at your company, whether that's you as the founder or an account manager. You know, you've got, let's say you look at your client base and you say, all right, 75% of our clients are very happy. Even those very happy ones, most of them won't participate in a case study, or maybe half of them. The ones that say yes to doing this, to taking time out of their day to help you, to go internally and get approvals and everything, they're the ones who really feel something towards you, that really like you. And it very often comes down to the relationship they have with their account manager or whoever they're interacting with, and that person needs to ask. Usually when things are going pretty well, of course. But that good relationship is what makes or breaks participation, in my experience.
Well, and you know, that's something that has resonated across, you know, everything that we see from an overall organizational growth perspective is, you know, how do they approach, how do they value, how do they nurture, you know, and how do they, even after a business contractual relationship is over, you know, how they maintain a personal relationship, which could drive, you know, some of those recommendations and referrals that, you know, are so valuable to all of us. relationships being key and king, you know, key and king. It's not really ultimately the content is helpful, but it's really us trying to be able to generate, you know, stronger relationships.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, you know, if we start looking at one of the things that you had mentioned before, talking about a little bit of lagging in the B2B area in regards to being able to use customer success to drive more sales or generate new sales, you kind of hit on a little bit, but maybe didn't put a number on it. If I was looking at the percentage of the marketplace, what would you say right now is the amount of organizations that are actually leveraging customer success insight and customer success impact in order to be able to drive their marketing and sales activity?
I'll answer separately for kind of small to medium companies and then larger companies. And I'll also say that they're using it, you know, I think almost all of them are trying to use this in some way. Someone's asking for referrals or, you know, name dropping someone, but let's say using it pretty well, where they have something documented in some sort of process. I would say of the smaller companies, only about 25% of companies that do a good job of this. 75% companies do a not very good job of it. For the bigger companies, I would say about, you know, at least half of them, no, 50 to 75% do a pretty good job, but only about 20, 25% of them really do it great and use it as a, you know, real competitive advantage. The interesting thing is if you look at the very top companies in the world, which we study, you know, a lot of what we do is not trying to reinvent the wheel or figure this all out, is we're looking at, you know, what is IBM, Salesforce, Google, and Microsoft, what are they doing? Not to copy it exactly, because there's different things there, but one thing that's interesting is all of them have 100 plus case studies and video testimonials organized by industry, by challenge, and by product, just the way that I described. So of the kind of the rest of the world, only some, maybe 25% are doing it really well like that, where they kind of have that set up. But it's interesting to note that the very top companies in the world all have it.
Well, and as, excuse me, as you're talking right there, somebody introduced a phrase to me the other day, which makes sense in a couple different ways in regards to, you know, strategy and approaches. And he talked about it being a market dominance play. If you, you know, to me, as what you just explained right there, you know, being a, you know, efficient and effective at, you know, being able to leverage this, you know, this insight and this impact, you know, really becomes almost a market dominance play.
Yeah, it's a way to really lock up a market, I think, both in their sales approach, but also like when people are making a comparison between you and a competitor or someone else, this is something that, you know, can't be replicated. Even if they can, you know, take parts of your service and save the same product, if you've been doing this for a while, it helps. I think we might be thinking of the same person, like build the moat, as they say, around your product. And obviously technical, people have always thought about that from a very technical perspective, to some extent a client list, but documented proof of people going on record talking about how you've helped with them really establishes you in a way from your competition that can't be faked.
Now, if you know, we always talk about, or you hear about, you know, the three-legged stool of, you know, marketing, sales, and then, you know, customer service or client success. I would dare to say also, you know, working across these and implementing, you know, this as a practice, would allow you to unify those at a significantly higher rate than you would otherwise.
Yes, that is the big opportunity in using case studies, that they're one piece of content that really can be used in many different areas across the business. But also what you described is what stops them from getting done. Because, you know, they really connect with several different departments. usually marketing is the one responsible for executing it, but they can't execute it without getting the customer success team to help them initiate the case studies. Oftentimes sales is the main users of the case studies, but you know, marketing has different uses for them. So there's all these different parties involved, and they can kind of get passed around and passed around. And it's one of the main, I hear this from people who become our clients directly. We had, you know, different people assigned to it. No one could fully own it. So what you described is both the both a challenge and a and an opportunity when it comes to this content.
Okay. So now what we're hearing too is a transformation that's going around in a lot of different organizations. For example, I was reading a study by one of the larger consulting firms, McKinsey or one of those, that had said the actual title of chief marketing officer is going away. Companies are actually doing away with their chief marketing officer. And what they're doing is, you know, implementing and taking in consideration, you know, more marketing operations, revenue operations. They're adding, you know, chief growth officer titles. They're you know, looking at, you know, trying to unify across those different organizations. Has that type of transformation also benefited the work that you do?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about it from that perspective. So I can't say for sure. But I will say that, yeah, the person that, and this is sort of related to what you're saying, the CRO title, who's really looking at both sales and marketing, I have noticed that the growth of that title helps us because that is such a interesting persona for us. As far as marketing changing and kind of splitting off into more of the automation and the operation side, I hadn't thought about it, so I don't know if it's had an impact on us.
Gotcha. So yeah, the other title was, you know, chief revenue officer. Organizations are, you know, adding chief revenue officer, chief growth officer, those types of titles, and then therefore shifting the responsibilities to help to, you know, speed up the whole transformation process.
Yeah.
That we can get, you know, full leverage and impact across all of those different departmental silos. Okay.
Right.
You know, we talked, reasons we talked about, you know, a lot of the, you know, high level impacts and all that. If you could just kind of, you know, walk us through a bit of a process to be able to implement.
To create the case studies.
Exactly.
Okay, cool. Tactical process. So let's imagine you're in marketing and you want to create case studies at your company. Here's a really simple process and approach. You're going to have to connect with two different departments. The first is the customer success department to help you identify candidates who will participate in a case study. To keep it simple, let's assume we're early on here. You're not building out a matrix. You're just trying to get some case studies done. So just you know, getting them to get you a list of, let's say, 5 to 10 candidates. I would always think if you have 5 to 10, if you have 6 people who you know are happy and you're going to, and you know, are really happy clients and they're recommended, you'll be lucky to get 3 of them to actually participate in the case study. So if you want a few case studies, think, how can I get a list of 5 to 10 potential clients? Next, talk to the sales team about what are the most important things that they're seeing in the sales process that would help to be able to address with stories. And again, this is just for getting started. You'll get a general idea. You'll probably see a few themes in them. Once you get that contact and you have the kind of background of what your sales team needs, you as the marketer kind of know what you need from a marketing perspective. I would set up a 20 to 30 minute Zoom call with the client, record it. And, you know, obviously I'm a little biased because this is what my company does, but it really does help to have a third party do this interview. But assuming that you don't have that ability, to really try during the interview to think more like a kind of reporter trying to understand them rather than a marketer looking for those kind of tidbits that explain your product. Because what people do wrong in case studies when they do them on their own is they make them too much about their own perspective and hitting their marketing points. And that stuff does not make an exciting case study. So really try to zoom out, almost pretend you know nothing, take on an investigative reporter style mindset, You don't have to craft the case study during this, and just interview them. Just learn. And if you want to think about it in a really simple approach, what was the problem they had before working with you? Why was it important? How do they just describe the solution that you provide and how it solves the problem? And what results or benefits were achieved by solving that problem? And just be really open-minded. And the reason I say is to record it and transcribe it is because when it comes time to write this, you know, you don't obviously don't want to be writing on the fly and you're going to interpret things in a certain way, but then use that transcript to build, you know, a piece of content that really speaks from that client's perspective. Then, you know, send it around to your marketing team, to your sales team to review, and then send it back to them for approval. You'll have to get it designed. And then you've got the written case study there. At that point, I would look to make a video out of it, whether that's getting them back on video or just using audio from the interview to create video, and different formats based on what channels you need. Obviously, they're not rocket science, but they're not that easy. So that's the kind of 2 to 3 minute version of how a marketer can approach getting case studies done.
Okay. So as you're talking, I also start, you know, looking at, well, without getting into specifics, because oftentimes they're client specific. I would dare to assume that we have some, you know, high level archetypes. Archetypes, thanks. You know, looking at the types of questions that we would actually be asking. And so I would assume that, you know, we're talking about some business impact, but we're also talking about personal impact. And then we're breaking down the question structure, the interview structure, you know, on some type of higher level framework. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I think different situations depend kind of how personal it gets, but the way that I would think about it, it's actually very, very much like what I learned in sales, which is not to kind of like, all right, let's talk about the business perspective and then let's talk about the personal perspective, but rather when they start to share a business problem, to ask follow-up questions. And some of those follow-up questions lead very directly to personal statements. Like, let's give an example. Let's say the client says, like, you know, we're, you know, yeah, we've reduced, you know, let's say it's a QuickBook, you know, it's a invoicing thing. Yeah, we've reduced invoice, you know, time to get paid on our invoice by 25%. That's great. That's the result. Everyone thinks, okay, that makes a great case study. But the professionals or the good investigator says, oh, okay, so before you made this solution, you were probably waiting a long time for invoices. Yeah. How did your CFO react to that? Oh, they would come. Oh, and how did that affect your job? How did that make you feel? You kind of knew that this could be better. You know, what steps and what were you thinking of ways to solve it? So then you get them not just saying, oh, we achieved this result. It was driving me. You get statements like, it was keeping me up at night because I would get an email from my CFO that would say, why aren't these paid? And I would have to respond in this way. If you think about that story and what I just described, and then think about a prospect evaluating a software like that, them seeing, oh, they can reduce invoice time 25%. Great. Everyone says that. But if they read, my CFO would send me an email about, you know, about the invoices and it would, you know, keep me up late Friday or like stop me from my Friday plans. They're like, oh, that happened to me. Like, that's the problem I'm dealing with. That's something I really connect with. So this may have been a little bit of a tangent from what you said, but the way to get into it is not to like say, I want to talk about this from a personal perspective, but to uncover the business challenges and occurrences and significant points, and then dig deeper into what those meant for the person. And there's a very positive side to this too, of then after, okay, once it got fixed, how did that make you feel? Oh, you know, the CFO sent me an email, you know, thanking me in front of everyone. It was amazing. I was the hero. And that's kind of how those personal elements get developed.
Well, you actually gave very real world examples of what I was essentially asking in regards to how we break down, you know, the process of capturing, you know, this, you know, customer success insight. And I would dare to say, if I start tying it into other data that exists out there, and looking specifically at a study that came out in regards to sales and B2B, saying how that, greater than 60% of all sales in B2B are actually lost to no decision. That those particular aspects, you know, of these client success stories are actually having a significantly greater impact of moving people off of no decision. Would that be fair to assess?
Yeah, it's something I hear from my clients all the time. And it leads us often to focus the case studies, like I keep saying, like not on the end result, which is great, but everyone kind of sees and doesn't really move that, but more on digging in to the person having a problem and taking action to solve it. You know, there's, you know, no magic bullet to get, you know, make all your, you know, get decisions and move indecisions along, but showing them examples of people who kind of are where they are and kind of feeling in that stuck position is the best thing that you can do.
Okay. So I think it's important to note when we start looking at, and you've done an excellent job of, you know, giving us some reasons and foundations and taking us through to some actual, you know, specific things tactically that we can apply, is where is this going? So if we think about, let's just look at the content example as it is. B2B has dramatically increased all of its content creation and development. And then AI is essentially 50xing that. I was chatting with someone the other day that said they're, for one of their particular personas, they're creating 10 AI generated blog posts a day because they want to create, you know, the demand, you know, for their product or solution with that particular target. When I start looking at even some of the tools and tactics that are being applied from a web perspective, you know, you have these pop-ups that say so-and-so just, you know, purchased our product. Now, typically those are in lower transactional type of solutions, not so much the higher ticket B2B things that we focus in on the B2B DM podcast. But, you know, where do you see the evolution of what you've been working on and developing over the past 7 years, you know, moving into?
Yeah, I think, you know, the 10 blog posts created by AI for the 10 different personas is interesting. Right now, I'm very skeptical of that approach, because if you really are that persona, I think you're going to be able to, you're not going to be intrigued by something that an AI wrote to hit your persona in most cases. So I'm personally very skeptical of that approach, at least as those technologies exist now. There is an element of it to case studies that affects it. So what I would also say is, I think, you know, there's part of this is that what makes case studies so effective, and I think a reason that they sort of like won't change, is because in this very changing dynamic content world where there's just more and more content for everything, case studies are one thing that you can't fake, unless you are doing something, you know, just completely illegitimate. You know, there's a real person, a real logo attached to it. So I think that in this kind of sea of content everywhere, things that, you know are real, become higher value. Now, there is an element of kind of using AI to repurpose really good case studies to help meet different personas, but it's not that simple. So I think that anyone who's thinking of this is like, oh, I'll just tell AI to create something for this persona. Like, you really have to have the story of why it is attached to them there. So what we're doing for some of our clients is we're interviewing one person and knowing that they may want to repurpose it into different case studies and things to meet different personas' interests. But it's not as simple as just doing one case study and saying, okay, here, let's make the version for them. You have to understand and talk to them about it from that persona's perspective. So I think things are obviously changing a lot, but I think that the idea that everyone's just going to have 10 times more content and that's going to solve their problems, I don't think it's going to work, because I don't think people want to read that. I think, and we already see this, but more and more people want to read something they know is written by a human. And you know, telling AI to make 10 different versions of something just won't cut it.
I think you hit on it a moment ago when you, and what I would actually interpret it as is the trust factor. We have to really look at that whole trust factor component, and is just creating more articles about, you know, your thought leadership and your, you know, product or service, is that really going to increase the trust factor when we have a society that is, you know, automatically apprehensive and protective? That's the thing that we have to be really careful of, because it's a pitfall. Yeah, I can generate a lot, but am I really impacting trust factor?
Exactly. You said it better than I can, I think, that, you know, B2B marketing, yeah, part of it's getting found, but a lot of it, like how many deals you lose because people don't trust you and don't believe in you, or aren't willing to risk their career on you, you know, building that out is a much bigger opportunity than getting a few more clicks on a, you know, AI created blog post.
So I'll tell you, great insight shared. Julian, how does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
Well, you can find our website at successkit.io. You can find me on LinkedIn. My name is Julian Lumpkin. I think I'm the only one there with that name, so pretty easy to find. And, you know, I'm pretty accessible through those channels. Feel free to DM me, or you can email me directly at julian@successkit.io. Happy to answer any questions about your case studies, or see if we can help with them.
Julian Lumpkin, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom, and we wish you the very best.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.